Helen Ladd is a professor of public policy studies and a professor of economics at Duke University and one of the nation's experts on education policy. Her research focuses on topics such as school accountability, education finance, teacher labor markets, and school choice. She also just concluded her term as president of the Association of Public Policy Analysis and Management, or APAM. Her closing address as president was titled Education and Poverty, Confronting the Evidence, which will be published as an article in APAM's journal. In the article, she notes that it's a well-known fact that students of disadvantaged households perform less well in school than their peers from advantaged backgrounds. Yet policymakers rarely confront that fact head-on. To increase student outcomes, she argues, we need to do more to address the ways in which poverty undermines student learning. She also has a recent New York Times op-ed on the same subject, co-authored with Edward Fisk, and I thank her for being our inaugural video interview. And Professor Ladd, the title of your paper, again, is Education and Poverty, Confronting the Evidence. What do we know about the correlation between being from a disadvantaged household and school performance?
So we know a lot about that, but let me just say a word about the title itself. You know, there's all this discussion in the Obama administration and among policymakers more generally about the importance of making decisions based on evidence. The starting point for my paper is the notion that there's one major piece of evidence out there. Doesn't take rocket science to see it. And policymakers are either denying it or ignoring that evidence. And that evidence is the strong correlation between family background and student achievement or educational attainment as well. So that evidence shows up whatever data you look at. It shows up if you look at data at the level of the individual student, students from high socioeconomic backgrounds or higher income backgrounds perform better on achievement tests. But it shows up across states as well. States with high poverty rates tend to have lower average achievement. States with low poverty rates have on average, much higher achievement. And then it also shows up in the international evidence in an interesting way. If you look at the data from individual countries and look at the patterns within those countries, so I'm talking about countries like Finland or Korea or Canada, all of which are very high-performing countries, what you see is that even within those countries, there is a very strong gradient between the socioeconomic background of the children and student achievement, in that case, is measured by test scores of 15-year-olds on PISA, which is an international test.
So the connection between socioeconomic status and educational outcomes is strong. In other words, whether you measure it by family income or the education of the mother, the connection between that and student test scores or other measures of student outcomes is obvious and strong. But as you point out in your paper, policymakers often overlook that connection. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, let me just highlight the fact that it is ignored, and sometimes it's actually denied. I would argue that the No Child Left Behind legislation, which was passed during the Bush years and is still in place in this country, actually denies that correlation. Just think what No Child Left Behind does. It sets the same high standard for every child, regardless of the socioeconomic background of the child. It sets the same requirements for growth and achievement and ultimate goal for every school, no matter what the mix of students in the school is. It's actually denying the relationship. But even the Obama policies, such as putting a lot of emphasis on test-based evaluation of teachers, trying to make the teachers work harder or more efficiently toward the goal of student achievement, or the whole charter school movement with the idea that the Obama administration is pushing to have more competition, and competition among schools will make schools more efficient and make them perform better. All of those efforts deny, well, in the case of the Obama policies, it's not that they deny the correlation. They set it to the side. They say, look, we as education policymakers can't do much about poverty or the backgrounds of students, so let's do better with what we do have, the education system, the schools themselves. So that sounds reasonable, and it's may generate some good outcomes. But if in fact the diagnosis is wrong, if people are attributing inefficient or attributing the poor performance in schools with lots of disadvantaged students to inefficiencies rather than to this strong correlation between family background and student achievement, then the policy solution of just trying to make schools more efficient and teachers work harder is not the right solution to the problem.
Okay, so many reforms focus on inefficiencies in the system. Your argument is if we want to have a bigger impact on student outcomes, we need strategies that specifically can reduce the adverse impact of low socioeconomic status on educational outcomes. Tell me about the research findings in terms of things that are effective in doing that.
Yeah. So there's a lot of research. In order for policymakers, and here I need to broaden it beyond education policymakers, because a key element of my argument is that education policymakers need to work closely with other policymakers. So if you're thinking about this at the level of a city government, the Department of Human Services and people in the housing department need to work closely with the education officials to address these problems. So how do we go about that, and how do I as a researcher or other researchers approach this? The first thing from a research point of view is to develop a better understanding of the ways in which poverty or family background impedes learning. And fortunately, there's a lot of good research out there. A lot of people have been doing research on health, for example, and there's clear causal evidence that children in families with low income tend to have poor health of a variety of types. They may have more toothaches. They may have more asthma. They may have more vision problems. They may have more stress. And this depression and stress is an important part of the story. And then there's additional evidence that shows how all of those characteristics lead to lower achievement and lower success in schools. So it's understanding those mechanisms. That's the first step. And then trying to find policy interventions to address them. So policy interventions might include things like putting health clinics in schools. And in some areas, that's beginning to happen. It would include funding more social workers or counselors to work in elementary schools, not just high schools. If kids are coming to school, especially in this day and age when lots of families are losing, or parents are losing jobs and families are being displaced because of home foreclosures, kids are coming to school facing a lot of stress. And so we need counselors in schools that can then link those children up to the services they need, both for themselves and also services that will help them address their own issues and as a result have fewer adverse spillover effects on other children in the class. Just one final point here. So there are a lot of different things that need to be done. And not only is there no single policy that will work, it's important to have a continuum of services. So, for example, one of the things that undoubtedly needs to be done is to improve access to high-quality childcare for all disadvantaged students so they come to school ready to learn. But if we then don't follow through on this and then make sure they have high-quality schools and enrichment programs during the summer and after-school programs, we're going to waste a lot of the benefits of the early childhood interventions. So we need a whole continuum of services.
I want to turn next to some examples. You cite examples of effective policies from as close to you as North Carolina to as far away as South Korea and Finland. Tell us about what works, what has been found to work in terms of helping low socioeconomic status students to succeed.
So the most famous one is the Harlem Children's Zone in New York, and that's been studied a lot, and there are some things about it that are working very well and others less well. I often also cite an example from my hometown of Durham, North Carolina. There's a new initiative there called the East Durham Children's Initiative, and it's still at a very early stage, but one of the things they're doing that excites me is the city officials and school officials are working with a large number of partner organizations, and this is the sort of activity that's needed, partnerships working on the whole continuum of services. Sometimes I'll cite the Say Yes to Education program in Syracuse. There's some after-school programs that seem to be terrific, and the evidence suggests they're working, such as Citizen Schools that runs out of Boston. So there are a variety of programs. We need to experiment with lots more, and once again, there's no single program that's going to work in every area. Programs need to be related to the particular situation. One just final thing, North Carolina has had quite good early childhood programs. So for years they've had a program called Smart Start for children for ages 0 to 5, both advantaged and disadvantaged. The notion is all children have various needs at that stage, and many families do as well. And then there's North Carolina has a preschool program. The reason I mention those programs is some of my own recent work suggests that those programs have had large positive effects on student achievement, but I'm distressed at the moment because budget cuts at the state level are leading to reductions in funding for some of these programs, and I fear that may happen in other states across the country.
Are there any efforts, any suggestions that you have for ways that we can encourage more states, more localities to try new things?
So we need to change the conversation in this country about education. The conversation ever since the late 80s and early 90s has been on accountability and high standards. I'm for high standards. As well, but we need to approach the problem in a positive, constructive way. And to me, that means addressing the needs of the individual children and not just bashing the teachers or labeling schools failures because they're trying to do something that no country in the world has done, which is to raise the achievement levels of all children to the same high level. What I want to have happen is I want the schools to provide an opportunity for every child to gain as much from the education system as possible. And to do that, we need to get rid of many of the barriers that are currently getting in the way of learning or educational success for those children. Related to that, I think we're making a mistake in this country putting so much emphasis on test scores as our measure of educational outcomes. Education is much broader than test scores, especially just test scores in math and reading. And until we change the conversation and move it away from a narrow focus on test scores and achievements and put greater emphasis on the broader set of skills and attitudes and ways of thinking that education is really about, we're not going to make much progress. in this field of education policy. So the way I want to spread the word is to change the conversation and have many more people talking about the broader goals of education and the positive, constructive ways that we might achieve some of those goals.
I want to end with one final question, which is taking that admonition to that we need to change the conversation of about education policy to the local level. And say we've got a mayor and a school board and a city residents that all agree that student outcomes are not acceptable. There's a lot of low-income students in the district, and graduation rates, test scores are not where we want them to be. How do we start that conversation? What's your advice about what to do first?
There are really two components to this set of things that I'd like the mayor to do. One is to pay attention to the schools, to make sure the schools are high quality and that the schools that serve large proportions of disadvantaged students have access to high quality school principals and high quality teachers. I want to emphasize this because sometimes I am misinterpreted as saying that I'm letting schools off the hook, and that's not right. It is important that we pay attention to the distribution of school quality. And right now, there in many cities, schools that serve disadvantaged students have lower quality or teachers with lower qualifications or less strong school principals. So the first thing I would do is to tell the mayor to make sure that the schools serving disadvantaged kids have quality inputs and quality processes within the schools. And then secondly, I'd consistent with everything I've been saying, I would encourage the mayor to put a high-level team of policymakers together, the school officials, people from the housing department, people from health and human services, so that they can work together to address some of the impediments to learning, especially the impediments faced by children from disadvantaged backgrounds.
My thanks to Helen Ladd for being with us today and for sharing her insights, and especially for being our very first scholar to be interviewed. I will post a link to her paper as well as to the New York Times op-ed. And there's a reason that I started with Professor Ladd on these interviews. I think her paper is one of the most interesting and worthwhile papers that I've read in a very long time on education policy and even broader. So thank you so much, Helen Ladd, for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Andy.